It's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. And I suggest you have a pencil and paper handy, because there might be something you want to write down, some information that you may want to file away and act on. Let's start off with the Central Coast Regional Snapshot Day. The 14th annual one is coming up Saturday, May 4th from 9 to 1 p.m. I know last week I might have said it was March. No, it is May. In partnership with the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary and hundreds of community volunteers, they will be sampling streams along 300 miles of the central coast of California. The Coastal Watershed Council is organizing teams of volunteers to monitor sites in Santa Cruz and San Mateo counties. Monterey and San Luis Obispo counties will be organized by the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. They'll be collecting water data such as pH, dissolved oxygen, electrical conductivity, transparency, bacteria, and nitrates and orthophosphates. If you want to find out what these are and why they're important to watershed health and get trained to do this sampling, that's going to happen on the following dates. In Santa Cruz, the training will happen on Saturday, April 27th from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., or there's a second class that same day from 1 to 3 at the Santa Cruz Yacht Harbor Public Meeting Room, 365 Lake Avenue, Suite A. And in San Mateo, the training will be on Monday, April 29th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the San Gregorio General Store at the corner of Highway 84 and Stage Road out on the coast there. In Monterey County, the training is on Sunday, April 28th from 10:30 to 12:30 at the REI Store, General Stillwell Drive in Marina. And San Luis Obispo training will happen Tuesday, April 30th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Coastal Discovery Center Hearst State Beach in San Simeon. And, of course, you can go to coastal-watershed.org to get more information about this. Just mark your calendar for Saturday, May 4th, for the 14th Annual Central Coast Regional Snapshot Day. Here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. Since our last update, 12 more wild buffalo have been killed by treaty hunters on lands north of Yellowstone National Park. Most of these buffalo were killed at Beatty Gulch. With so many gut piles left on this small section of public land very close to people's homes, there have been real concerns about attracting grizzly bears who find gut piles delicious after a long winter nap. Gardner Patrols report that Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks game wardens were seen consolidating the remains for possible removal. Yellowstone National Park's goal of killing 450 wild buffalo through hunting and or slaughter this year has been nearly halfway met, with over 205 wild buffalo killed by hunters this year. That treaty hunting will end March 31st. On Thursday, Yellowstone again made public their intentions to begin capturing wild buffalo in the park's Stevens Creek Bison Trap. Buffalo Field Campaign contacted park officials who told us that capture could happen while hunting is taking place, though they prefer hunters to do most of the killing and hence carry the burden of blame. If buffalo are captured, they would be sent to slaughter and research facilities. 63 young buffalo are wanted by the USDA Animal Plant and Health Inspection Service for their continued experiments with Gonicon, a chemical pesticide birth control agent. Another 200 wild buffalo would be rounded up for slaughter. Spring could be the saving grace. Calving season is less than 6 weeks away. Yellowstone doesn't want a black eye for slaughtering buffalo heavy with calves. Some areas of Yellowstone are already greening up, so buffalo are slowly vacating their winter ranges. It's like a macabre race between spring and Yellowstone's killing plans. While Yellowstone plans to slaughter of wild buffalo, the Montana legislature is busy trying to legislate wild buffalo out of Montana or make their lives miserable. Opposition to these efforts is strong and growing. On Wednesday in Helena, Montana, based Native American leaders led a powerful rally for the buffalo, sharing cultural and spiritual connections and inspiring people to take action for the gentle giants. After that rally, the Buffalo Field Campaign attended a hearing on State Bill 341, I guess that's Montana Senate Bill 341, a bill that would make it costly and difficult to restore predators, large game animals, and endangered species in Montana. There was a single proponent of the bill at the hearing, while nearly 20 opponents spoke out against it for buffalo and other wildlife. On Wednesday, the Montana newspaper, the Billings Gazette, ran an opinion editorial from Buffalo Field campaign which sheds light on harmful bills moving through the Montana legislature. We have updated and revised our webpage information pertaining to Yellowstone's capture and slaughter plans and the Montana legislature page. And unfortunately, the Buffalo Field campaign is homeless in Gardner. The Buffalo Field campaign needs a new Gardner, Montana camp. After years of support from our friends at the Yellowstone Raft Company, Buffalo Field Campaign's Gardner headquarters is no longer available and we had to evacuate last week. Thanks to the kind-hearted ally and superb photographer Kim Kaiser, we have a home for the upcoming week, but beyond next week, we are homeless in Gardner. With typical rents in the area of $500 to $600 a month, this is a significant unplanned expense. More than 400 buffalo are currently occupying the Gardner Basin, and the Park Service is anxious to kill hundreds and send another 63 to the APHIS research facilities for a birth control experiment. If you have a place near Gardner, Montana, where three Buffalo Field campaign volunteers could stay between now and the middle of May, or if you could donate money to help us rent a place, the Buffalo Field campaign could definitely use your help. Send your donations to Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana. The zip code is 59758. If you have any questions, give them a call at area code 406-646-0070. And if you need further information, go to their webpage at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And do remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And you're needed to act now to stop destructive post-fire salvage logging in the Mendocino National Forest in this story by Kimberly Baker of the Environmental Protection Information Center. The Mendocino National Forest has released an environmental analysis for post-fire logging on 985 acres in the Mill Fire area outside of the town of Stonyford, California. Public comment is due by March 25th. Please act now to stand up for forests, wildlife, and watersheds. Although the vast majority of the forest marked as timber sale units actually burned at moderate or low severity, with many live trees remaining within these stands, the agency claims the stands are in a deforested condition and are not functioning normally. This claim is used to justify removing most of the trees in the units, including live green trees, totaling nearly 1,000 acres of ecologically unnecessary post-fire salvage logging. The emergency situation determination that the Mendocino planners are seeking streamlines environmental review, reduces public recourse, and would allow logging to begin immediately after a decision by the forest supervisor despite an appeal or pending lawsuit. Now is the time for the public to speak up and voice their opposition to this undemocratic decision-making process. It is clear that timber volume is driving this project, running over ecology and the best available science. One statement made in the emergency situation determination letter after land managers met with timber industry representatives, quote, "It was concluded that the sale would need to contain enough volume to cover move-in and move-out costs of logging operations, as well as high haul costs from this remote area of the forest," unquote. The project is within the Blue Slides Late Successional Reserve. The reserves are set aside to preserve old-growth forest and species like the northern spotted owl that depend on big old trees for survival. Damaged and dead trees, also known as snags, are important structural components of late successional forests and are key habitat for numerous species. They provide forage cavities for nesting and protection, perch sites, and den sites. Large snags are considered to be one of the distinctive features of an old-growth forest. Fire and tree mortality are natural elements of a forest ecosystem. Logging of large snags does not contribute to recovery of forest habitat. In fact, the only activity more antithetical to the recovery process would be removal of surviving green trees from burned sites, which the Mendocino timber planners are proposing to do in this project. Much of the area is already naturally regenerating. Logging with ground-based equipment such as tractors and bulldozers on fragile soils will inhibit and kill this natural growth. Post-fire landscapes and snag forests are alive and vibrant. They are more biologically diverse than unburned forest and provide an array of plant and animal species. Post-fire landscapes are considered to be one of the most rare, endangered, and ecologically important forest habitat types in western U.S. forests, and the stand-transforming fires that create this habitat are not damaging to forest ecosystems. Rather, they are advancing ecological restoration. So, please act now to protect your public lands. Please ask the Mendocino National Forest to cancel destructive post-fire logging within the Blue Slides Late Successional Reserve. And for more information on this and how to participate, go to www.wildcalifornia.org. And now we turn to biological diversity news. This news is provided to us from the Center for Biological Diversity. And we're a little behind on this news, so I'm going to just read a whole bunch of it tonight. Great white sharks have moved closer to protection in California following a petition submitted by the Center for Biological Diversity and partners last August. Great white sharks living off the coast of California are now official candidates for protection under the state's Endangered Species Act. The California Fish and Game Commission voted to begin a one-year study of this white shark population to find out if it qualifies for state protection. With only about 350 adult sharks estimated to remain along the entire West Coast, there may be fewer than 100 reproductive females in existence, a dangerously low number. The targeting and sale of white sharks is already banned, but these ocean predators are all too often caught and killed accidentally by fishermen targeting swordfish, California halibut, and white sea bass. Sharks are such amazing animals, but despite their power, they're actually incredibly vulnerable to the terrible way we treat our oceans, said the center's Emily Jeffers. Three groups have also submitted a petition to protect the West Coast great whites under the Federal Endangered Species Act. A decision on that petition is expected in June. A rare Southern California plant has gotten 9,600 acres of protected habitat. A rare plant that only lives in Southern California is finally getting protected habitat. The Coachella Valley milk vetch, which has been protected under the Endangered Species Act since 1998, will now have four areas of protected habitat in Riverside County, amounting to 9,600 acres. The decision by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service came in response to a lawsuit filed by the Center for Biological Diversity in 2009 that challenged a bush area decision not to protect any habitat for the plant. The Coachella Valley milkfetch, related to the pea plant, is a short-lived perennial covered with white silky hairs and beautiful purple flowers. It's threatened by development, groundwater pumping, non-native plant species, off-highway vehicle impacts, and the alteration of stream flows. And the latest Endangered Species Act success story, the island night lizard. The island night lizard, which lives only on California's Channel Islands, is the latest Endangered Species Act success story. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has said that the lizard, protected since 1977, has recovered to the point where protections under the Act can be lifted. The 4-inch lizard was pushed to the brink of extinction through habitat destruction by non-native goats and pigs. The removal of these goats and pigs was a key part of a recovery plan written in 1984. Today, there are more than 21 million, with an M, island night lizards living on the Channel Islands. The recovery of the island night lizard and its habitat is a real cause for celebration, both for this animal and for the Endangered Species Act, with its long record of success, says Colette Atkins-Geis, the Center for Biological Diversity's specialist on reptiles and amphibians. Through the cooperative efforts of federal agencies, this once vanishing species is now on a steady path to survival. And bobcat trapping is on the rise in California. Bobcats are amazing, hardy creatures capable of traveling 25 to 30 miles a day and of roaming throughout suburbs other big cats can't abide. But they can't see the invisible lines in the sand. That's a problem in Southern California's Joshua Tree National Park, because while bobcats are safe inside the park, they're increasingly falling prey to trappers just outside the park boundaries. Bobcats are trapped for their pelts, which can fetch up to $600 in places like China and Russia. The number of commercial trappers killing bobcats in California has more than doubled in the past year as pelt prices have soared. Residents of the Joshua Tree recently discovered traps on the boundaries of the national park, and several well-known bobcats who once prowled the park boundaries for years suddenly disappeared this trapping season. But the problem is not limited to Joshua Tree. Trapping of bobcats is booming throughout California. You'd think that lining the boundary of a national park with traps to kill the park's wildlife would be illegal, but in California, it's unfortunately perfectly legal. The Center for Biological Diversity is launching a statewide campaign to change the law and ban this archaic and cruel practice. And I must add that that legislation is in the state right now, state legislature right now. The Environmental Protection Agency limits the most toxic rat poisons in home, but leaves wildlife at risk. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has put new limits on some of the most dangerous rat poisons. Excellent news for the 10,000 children who are accidentally exposed to rat poison in their homes every year. But the decision allows continued use of the poisons for agricultural and other purposes, threatening thousands of animals a year when they consume poisoned rodents. Wildlife poisonings and death have been documented in eagles, hawks, falcons, owls, bobcats, mountain lions, and the endangered San Joaquin kit fox. The EPA's order comes after years of opposition from Decon rat poison manufacturer Reckitt Benckiser, which has fought the EPA to limit tamper-resistant packaging and keep super toxic rat poisons on the shelves. I'm very relieved the EPA is taking this significant step to protect our families from accidental poisoning, said Jonathan Evans of the center, which works to reduce the exposure of both people and wild animals to toxins. But wildlife, too, need protection from these cruel, indiscriminate, and deadly toxins. It's time to get them out of the wild. And a suit has been launched to save 90% of the caribou's protected habitat. After a petition and lawsuit by the Center for Biological Diversity and its allies, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in 2011 proposed to protect more than 375,000 acres of critical habitat for the endangered mountain caribou. But in November of 2012, the service finalized protection for just a tiny sliver of that area, only about 30,000 acres, so the center has filed a notice of intent to sue. Majestic herds of wildland caribou once roamed across much of the northern lower 48 states. Now only a small population, the mountain ecotype of woodland caribou, clings to life in the Rocky Mountains of northern Idaho and northeastern Washington. These last U.S. caribou are specially adapted for deep snow, with dinner plate-sized hooves that let them nimbly walk atop it, plus an amazing ability to survive on nothing but tree lichens throughout the winter. But the caribou's hardiness can't save them from threats like snowmobiles, roads, and habitat loss. They need more safeguarded acreage than originally proposed, 375,000, but not less. This reduction in protected habitat is a death sentence for mountain caribou in the United States, said the center's Noah Greenwald. And new measures will help protect wolves in the California coyote hunt. State wildlife officials in California have refused to call off a coyote hunt in Modoc County a few months ago, but agreed to a series of additional measures recommended by the Center for Biological Diversity and its allies. We raise serious concerns about the hunt for several reasons, including the fact that it's scheduled in an area within the range of OR7, the first wild wolf in California in nearly nine decades. The California Fish and Wildlife Department received almost 10,000 comments from members and supporters of the center who opposed that coyote hunt. Thank you. Following a hearing that included testimony from Amarok Wise, our West Coast wolf organizer, wildlife officials agreed to tell the hunt sponsors and participants that shooting a wolf violates state and federal law and to educate participants on the physical differences between coyotes and wolves. The agency will also provide wardens to also provided wardens that ensured that the hunt complied with the law. And the center is pleased that state officials took extra measures to reduce the risk to wolves. And I sort of have to change that writing because of the time. And here's news of the weird and wild, why one small, adorable birdie is called the zombie tit. Common throughout Europe and Asia, the great tit, or Parus major, is a colorful wee bird that produces a lovely chirping song. It's also known to many as the zombie tit, and for terribly good reasons. Like all birds, zombie tits belong to a subgroup of theropods, making them living descendants of some of the dinosaur kingdom's fiercest predators, like Tyrannosaurus rex. And yeah, those sweet-looking little zombie tits also eat brains. They eat bat brains, the brains of other birds, brains, and more brains. And while most of their diet consists of insects, seeds, and fruit, zombie tits have also been documented cracking and slurping the skulls of 10 birds for a single meal. They'll even sneak into caves to gulp down the cranial contents of hibernating bats. Yet more evidence that ferocious dinosaurs live on. An endangered species protection has been proposed for wolverines. One of the West's rarest predators is finally on its way to federal protection. Under the Center for Biological Diversity's 757 Species Agreement, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed Endangered Species Act protection for American wolverines, the feisty solitary hunters that once roamed a large swath of the mountainous West, but are now severely threatened by climate change. There are only 250 to 300 left in the lower 48 states. The center has been working to protect wolverines, whose population has shrunk drastically since 1995. The federal listing for the animals will likely put an end to Montana's plans to allow wolverine trapping and could bring reintroduction of the rare creatures to Colorado. More frustratingly, the Fish and Wildlife Service says the listing can't be used to address the greatest threat to wolverines, the global climate crisis. The wolverine has a reputation for killing prey many times its size, but it's no match for global climate change, which is shrinking spring snowpack across the West, said Noah Greenwald, the center's endangered species director. If we're going to save the wolverine and countless other wildlife species, as well as the world we all depend on, we need to take immediate steps to substantially and quickly reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And a southwestern wolf was released into the wild and quickly recaptured. First, the good news. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, after 4 years of delay, released a new Mexican gray wolf into the wild on January 7th. The bad news, 3 weeks later, government agents recaptured the wolf in New Mexico, stuck him back in captivity apparently because he had wandered outside the established territory of his intended mate, the alpha female of Bluestem Pack, which lost its alpha male to a criminal shooting last summer. There was more good news, bad news for Southwest wolves. It was announced that the population had increased to 75 in 2012, up from 58 a year ago. Unfortunately, the number of breeding pairs has dropped from 6 to 3. The Center for Biological Diversity has been fighting for years to increase the number of wild wolves, to halt genetic inbreeding, and to stop government shooting and trapping of wolves. If wolves are truly to return and recover in the Southwest, said the center's Michael Robinson, more wolves must be released into the wild. And a suit has been launched in Missouri to protect Ozark hellbenders. The Center for Biological Diversity and a local partner notified two federal agencies that they intend to sue over their failure to protect the Ozark hellbender, Hinds emerald dragonfly, Tumbling Creek cave snails, and two endangered mussels in Missouri's Mark Twain National Forest. We want the U.S. Forest Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to revisit the Mark Twain's 2005 forest plan to make changes that will help save endangered species and essential habitats on the forest. Aquatic species that have gained their federal protection status since 2005. Poorly managed recreation and timber harvest pollutes waterways on the Mark Twain National Forest that the Ozark hellbender needs to survive, said the center's Colette Adkins-Geese. To save the hellbender, we have to protect the rivers that people treasure too for drinking water, fishing, and boating. The lawsuit will likely result in a forest plan amendment, for instance, the prohibition on construction of bridges or boat ramps near hellbender habitat. And the feds have denied polar bears protection from greenhouse gas pollution. After months of high-profile statements about climate change, The Obama administration finalized a rule that fails to protect polar bears from greenhouse gas pollution under the Endangered Species Act. The new 4D rule dates from the Bush era and excludes activities occurring outside polar bear habitat, notably carbon emissions causing global warming and its sea ice melt, from being addressed to prevent the bear's extinction. Polar bears were the first species protected under the act after a Center for Biological Diversity petition solely because of threats from global warming. They need Arctic sea ice, which reached a record low last summer, to survive. The Fed's special rule comes just days after a new report from 12 leading polar bear scientists urged governments to plan for rapid ecosystem changes that could send key bear populations into abrupt decline. Without help, more than two-thirds of the planet's polar bears, including all bears in Alaska, will likely be gone by the year 2050. The Obama administration's strong climate rhetoric is completely at odds with this weak decision not to protect polar bears from carbon pollution, said the center's Brendan Cummings. And more news from the wild and weird, sperm whales adopt a disabled dolphin. Sperm whales, like Moby Dick, the villainous white whale from Herman Melville's classic novel, may be due for a public relations makeover. According to a forthcoming paper in the journal Aquatic Mammals, scientists discovered what appears to be the adoption of a malformed bottlenose dolphin by a pod of sperm whales. The dolphin calf, which has a rare spinal curvature that probably stops it from keeping up with its own kind, was observed traveling for many days with a pod of whales. Scientists saw the whales nuzzling and playing with the dolphin. It really looked like they had accepted the dolphin for whatever reason, said one of the scientists. They were being very sociable. He also said that as far as he knew, sperm whales, fairly aloof cetaceans, have never been known to mingle with another species in this way. And genetically engineered salmon could hurt wild salmon. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration planned to approve genetically engineered salmon for general consumption in the next few months, which could be catastrophic for wild salmon populations that already have an uphill battle for survival. The proposal would deregulate Aqua Advantage salmon, a genetically engineered fish that combines the genetic material of Atlantic and Chinook salmon, as well as that of sea eels, to supercharge their growth rates. The FDA approval of these frankenfish means that they will end up on grocery store shelves without any indication that the food is genetically modified. The agency claims there's no possibility of significant environmental impact from deregulation, but if genetically engineered salmon escaped into the environment, they would compete against native salmon and potentially spread diseases to struggling wild populations. And farm salmon frequently escape into the wild. It would take only a few genetically engineered fish to push an entire wild salmon population to the brink of extinction. So please tell the FDA to prevent frankenfish from invading our rivers, streams, and supermarkets. Population growth boosterism, an idea whose time has passed. Chicago's public radio station WBEZ has launched a marketing campaign urging listeners to breed more so that their fund drive in the year 2032 will be a success. Loyal NPR listeners make more loyal NPR listeners, right? Yeah, we get that it's meant to be a clever and tongue-in-cheek promotion, but Jerry Karnas, the Center for Biological Diversity's Population Campaign Director, also saw it as an opportunity to talk about something more serious. The price that wildlife and our environment pay when the human population grows and grows. Jerry's op-ed, published in Chicago's Daily Herald, points out that we're already adding 200,000 more people to the planet every day, and that we're on track to hit another 10 billion people by the year 2050. The cost? All these people will gobble up land and water, pollute the air, accelerate the extinction of animals, and push our climate perilously close to disaster, he said. And that spells trouble for panthers, sea turtles, wolves, frogs, salamanders, and all species around the globe. It's not rocket science, Jerry wrote in his piece. The more people we crowd onto the planet, the less room there is for animals and the wild places we love, and the less room there is for human quality of life. And our final little piece here from the wild and weird, the first ever video of a thought being born. Recently, a team of Japanese biologists captured the first ever footage of a thought forming in the brain. And if you look that up on Google or YouTube, you'll see what appears to be an aerial view of a lightning storm. Those flashes are thoughts appearing as glowing neurons activated in the gray matter of a zebrafish in response to seeing prey. In other words, this cranial light show translates roughly from minnow into English as lunch. And that's it for the Earth First Update for this week. The Earth First Update is presented every week here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. You can hear the show at 9 o'clock on Thursday night and again at 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon. You can also hear the Earth First Update on KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, Idaho, at 92.5 FM. On Monday nights at 9:30. You can also download a podcast at radioforall.net. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We want to thank you for listening, and do tune in to another Earth First Update.